Decentraland Podcast with David Amoyala.
Bienvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of the week of the Calcioland podcast. So today we have our game picks with our friend Thousand Names. We are going to be paying tribute to him because of the Guardiola story to Juve's picking up steam. Don't forget that Thousand Names is the one who told us about this on the podcast the last time we had him on a few months ago. We have a couple of interviews coming for you. We have our friend John Solano going to talk about Roma on the pitch, but especially everything going on with Antonio Conte, the rumors on that. So I think you'll enjoy that update. We have our usual great Twitter questions. We also have a bonus section of the questions for our patrons. As always, thanks for your support. And we're going to close with Andrew Barker. You guys know he's one of my favorite guests. We got into Inter, and we talked a lot about documentaries. As you guys know, Andrew covers movies, and we closed on the documentary on Maradona, which I have to tell you, I am beyond excited about. But before we get to all that stuff, we are joined by our great friend, the producer, the co-host of the podcast, Alex. Great to see your own podcast blowing up. So, Alex, I'm going to ask you this way, since you've been following Pep at Man City pretty closely. You know Juve very well because of this podcast. So before we get into the likelihood of Guardiola coming to Juve, I'm going to ask you about an observation that Thousand Names had. He believes that Juve's current roster, as it is right now, that the squad is actually better suited for Guardiola's style than it is Allegri's. And that's one of the reasons why Juve is looking to make the change. So do you agree with that assessment? Can you see where he's coming from with that?
Definitely, David. I can definitely agree with that. I see where he's coming from. And just in preparing for my answer and really just kind of thinking about the roster of Juventus and if they at all fit Guardiola, obviously, let me just say, they obviously fit Max Allegri. They've been fitting Max Allegri for a while. And yes, you can say to me, well, they're not doing well in the Champions League or not as well as they should be. Fine. But they're fitting Max Allegri just fine, winning all these Scudettos. But maybe they are fitted better for someone like Pep Guardiola. Now, I feel like your knee-jerk reaction, David, when you think about Pep and you think about Juventus, is they're not a fit at all, just because Juventus have this reputation of maybe being more pragmatic, maybe being more defensive-minded. Even Antonio Conte, once upon a time, kind of gave them a boring tag that I think some frustrated fans can not let go of. But if you think about it a lot deeper, Pep Guardiola, obviously a manager who likes some exciting up-and-down football and even is okay to be vulnerable at the back just to have a much stronger attack, he has some pieces, he would have some pieces in this Juventus team that I think he could do wonders with, in my opinion. Now, obviously, Ronaldo, he would figure out what to do with Ronaldo. Any manager can figure out what to do with Ronaldo. And once again, David, you always say Max Allegri is phenomenal at managing superstars. So Ronaldo, he'll do fine anywhere. But think about somebody like Paulo Dybala, first of all, where I'd be interested, maybe I'm being a little too simplistic about the whole Argentinian side of things, but I'd be interested to see what Pep Guardiola could do with Paulo Dybala, another short Argentine who might be best in the middle of the pitch. That's not to say Aguero was made by Pep, far from it. Aguero was a household name before Pep, but certainly Pep would understand maybe some qualities he could use in Dybala that he's used in Aguero. But also, he's so good at the rotation, David. That's what Pep is so good at with his A and B squads. I mean, I always say it. Manchester City squad, their B squad is almost some people's A. And he's okay if he has to use a Gabriel Jesus in another game or backup wingers. And on Juventus, he would have that. He would have Moise Kean, who's obviously coming into his own and becoming a player that even Allegri in big games is not afraid to play. But also Douglas Costa. I think Pep Guardiola would have some fun with him. And Bernardeschi. I mean, I'm all of a sudden seeing a lot of things Pep Guardiola could do with a lot of talented offensive players. And I'm not sure, David, your boy Mario Mandzukic would figure as much into a Pep Guardiola team just because of the way Pep likes to play. But I think there are so many other players that would. And honestly, just to kind of end my answer here, Pep likes some attacking fullbacks. Who doesn't these days? But you talk about how Juve might be willing to move on from Alexandro at this point, but come on, how about an Alexandro and João Cancelo fullback tandem under Pep Guardiola? I mean, David, that's naughty thoughts for Pep Guardiola. So I like to take my thousand names. I really, really do. So, you know, that's my take on if he would be a good fit. I actually do think he would be a good fit and maybe arguably better than Allegri. But what about you and David? How likely is it after I've spieled that Pep would join Juventus?
So let me piggyback on what you were saying about the fits. And let's look just at players that Guardiola has been linked to. We have Bonucci, who he's pursued multiple times. So center back, really, really good passing-wise, maybe not so great defensively, and that's probably being generous. So we have a fit there. Man City was the runner-up in the race for Alexandro when he was at Porto, and Juve ended up winning that race. So he likes him. If Juve were to move on, I'd say Spinazzola is a wing-back that would suit Guardiola really well. I think João Cancelo, his style of play, perfect for Guardiola. Pjanic is another player that he's been linked to. If he stays at Juve, I could see him being a nice fit there. And I think he'd be great if anyone could kind of relaunch Dybala, a player that really we don't know exactly what his role is with a manager like Guardiola, where roles maybe aren't as important. It'd be a really good fit. So I think Thousand's really onto something there. I think if you hand it over the squad as it is today, maybe it fits Guardiola better than Allegri. Actually, I'll say it fits better. Now, how likely is it? So we had Thousand on here, I think it was about 6 weeks ago or so. And he's like, yeah, you know, it's what I heard. I think it's going to happen. I don't know how much of an insider he is with that stuff. But let's give, as in Italy, we say, diamo a Cesare quello che è di Cesare. Let's give Caesar what belongs to Caesar. He's the first one that talked about Cáceres at Juve. And it happened. So I think Juve, it really comes down to if Allegri moves on, I would imagine it would only be for Conte or Guardiola. I'm just not so sure Manchester City is going to let him go. A few months ago, Guardiola said himself that he wasn't going to Juve. He flat out said it. He said, I'm under contract. It's not going to happen. Now, I know this hasn't been a particularly great season in the Champions League for Man City, so I'm not sure how much that changes. But I just also, when I look at the market, I'm just not sure who could eventually replace Guardiola at Man City. But I'm sure this is something that Juve is at least considering. If they are just as sick as a lot of other people are with the complaints on the style, on Allegri, the way he plays, I think there's really no one that's more radically different than him than Guardiola. But, you know, if you look at his track record in the Champions League, recently, it's not that great. I would say Allegri's been slightly better in the Champions League, but you would certainly get help style-wise. So as it stands now, I'm not so sure how likely it is, but I was pretty excited for Thousand because there's a lot of people in Italy that have been talking about it since that happened. So let's see what happens, but I definitely think it would be quite intriguing. I'd see Juve signing Guardiola as kind of coup along the lines of Ronaldo. I personally didn't think Ronaldo was coming to Juve. Even on the day that it happened early, I still had my doubts, and it happened. So I've learned maybe not to doubt Juve that much anymore. Guardiola has connections to Italy. I could see him at some point coming to Italy, but as it stands now, I'd still be more surprised if it happens than it doesn't.
Well, you said on the last episode, you talked to somebody and they said it could be a very exciting summer in Serie A, so maybe that's not what they were talking about, but hey, Pep Guardiola to Juve would be very, very exciting. And also, David, we've been speaking of Thousand Names and we're talking about exciting, so what's more exciting than game picks with you and Thousand Names? Let's look ahead to this weekend in Serie A. Who do we got?
So you guys know the drill by now. We pick three games. He picks the matches. I have the advantage of knowing what his picks are. So first one, Derby della Mole, a game that matters much more to Torino than it does to Juve, which really at this point has really nothing to play for. So Thousand has Juve beating Torino 2-0. Goals by Pjanic and Chiellini. I don't even need to translate this. Ronaldo sbaglia rigore. He says Allegri is going to move ahead thanks to help from the referees. And he says the helps from the referees are so obvious, it's going to be a disgrace to the memory of Superga. And that's the very famous Torino team from the 50s that died in a plane crash at Superga. And he says that Torino's president, Cairo, is ridiculous. I imagine this has to do with complaining on referees, which Cairo has done a lot this season. In Italian, Juve Torino 2-0, Pjanic Chiellini, Ronaldo sbaglia il rigore, Allegri avanti ancora con gli aiutini arbitrali, disonorata la memoria di Superga, Cairo ridicolo. I've been riding the Torino train for quite some time. I'm glad a lot of people are starting to recognize them as well. I'm going to go with them winning 1-0 with a goal by Belotti. So Fausen has Juve winning, I have Torino. Next one, exciting match. Roma traveling to Liguria to face Genoa. Fausen has Roma winning 3-0, goals by Schick, Dzeko, and Manolas. He says Ranieri is going to get really close to clinching the qualification to the Champions League. He says that Di Francesco was an absolute tragedy at Roma this season as manager, and that Genoa president Preziosi deserves Serie B. In Italian, Genoa, Roma 0-3, Schick, Dzeko, Manolas, Ranieri ipoteca la qualificazione in Champions, Di Francesco è stata una sciagura, Preziosi merita la B. This is a little bit tough because Genoa is almost out of the race to avoid relegation, but not quite yet. They've really struggled scoring goals, and Roma's defense been a lot better. So I'm going to agree with Fausen, but I'm going to have Roma winning 1-0, and I'm going to give a goal to Dzeko as well. Last match, really important one for the race for the Champions League. We have Lazio hosting Atalanta. Fausen has it 1-1, goals by Radu and Deron. Lemon Inzaghi never wins the direct confrontation against the good teams in the league, but that Gasperini is not even going to finish in sixth place. So Fausen is predicting Atalanta is going to fall apart in the run on to the league. Now, Lazio is still a little bit in the race for a Champions League spot. Really important match. Atalanta is actually better on away matches than they are at home. So I'm going to agree with a draw, and I'm going to go 2-2, and I'll go Immobile, Correa, who's been on fire, and Papu Gomez and Zapata. So to recap, I have Torino beating Juve. Fausen has Juve winning. We both have Roma beating Genoa, and we agree with Lazio and Atalanta drawing. So thanks, Fausen Ames. We're going to have him on actually soon. He's been itching to come back on the podcast. We're going to talk about the Deadwood movie. He's a big fan of that show, so I look forward to that. And now, next up, we have our great friend, John Solano. You guys know, if you've been listening to the podcast, we've had John. I think he's our most frequent guest. So we're going to talk about everything that's going on at Roma, and especially the Conte rumors. So I'm excited that today we have two of our regular guests who always bring it in very different ways. So we're going to start off with our dear friend, John Solano. Anyone who's listened to the podcast for a while knows John really, really well. For those of you that aren't that familiar with him, he's the editor of one of my favorite websites out there, and that's IS Roma Press. What I love about this one, this isn't just a news aggregator by any means. John is very plugged in, has a lot of exclusive news. So if you're a Roma fan or a Serie A fan, definitely check that out. And then another excellent podcast, the Serie A Show, which features two other of our regular guests, Chloe and Nima. John's kind of the host, and it's really fun chats. John also has been featured on Roma's official site and Euro Fantasy Games. So, John, it's always a real pleasure to chat with you. Welcome back to Calcioland.
Absolutely. Happy to be back.
Awesome. So let's talk a little bit about Roma. So there's been a lot of buzz off the pitch, which you've been covering really well, which we'll get to in a second. But I want to ask you about the resurgence under Ranieri. So we're recording on Tuesday after a very good Serie A weekend for Roma, their win against Cagliari. So a lot has changed, John, in the race for the Champions League spots in the past few weeks. So as it stands now, what odds do you give Roma? How confident are you that they can make it back?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, if you would have asked me the same question a month ago, I would have told you next to zero. But it's quite an indictment on the change Ranieri has made. And also, I think it's also an indictment on how much of a slip-up that these other teams had. I mean, Roma have given all of these sides, Lazio, Torino, Atalanta, Milan. I mean, they gave them a 2 to 3 month window to just grab this place by the horns, and nobody has done it. And it's honestly shocking to me that Roma, that we're sitting here today, even, you know, entertaining the idea that they could qualify for the Champions League, because in January, February, I thought that was nearly impossible. So I think the odds are actually pretty good, especially when you look at the upcoming calendars of Milan, Atalanta, and compare those to Roma's. Obviously, this weekend is going to be big. Roma, they play away to Genoa. Atalanta play Lazio. And I do think that that's going to be a difficult match for Atalanta. It's obviously going to be difficult for Roma as well. We've seen how their away form has been this entire season, but these past few weeks, they've certainly been a different team. The only problem is I never like the team that you support being in the position where you have to rely on others to slip up,
yeah.
Whereas you can sort of control your own destiny just by winning. So unfortunately, Roma will have to play spectator at some point. But it is interesting because I don't know what you think, David. I do think Gasparini is in quite a interesting position, because if I were him, I mean, I would be going very low risk within these next few weeks. Obviously, Champions League for a club like Atalanta is just a spectacular goal. But I don't know if I would risk the Coppa at the expense of a Champions League place. Maybe that's the supporter in me thinking ahead of the pragmatic side. But I mean, I'm of the mindset anytime there's a chance for silverware, I never want to risk that. So I'll especially be curious to see what Atalanta does, because I think they have a difficult match against Lazio, as I said, at the weekend. And then they have to play Juve in a couple of weeks as well, whereas Roma also had to face Juve. So I'll be curious to see how Juve handles it as well, because I wonder if they, I mean, they have nothing to play for.
Conspiracy theorists and Juve haters, I feel like Juve playing such a key role in this race makes it certainly very, very interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, and it's coming a week after they wrap up the Scudetto. So it's quite the conundrum that each of these clubs find their particular selves in. It's interesting. I mean, you could take a different approach with each of these sides. And again, I feel like Juve, I mean, even if they were to go full strength, Roma always play them well at the Olimpico. So thankfully, it isn't going to be a Turin, but I'll be curious to see what they do and what Allegri opts to do in these matches, because he could certainly play the role of spoiler for the side of his choice. So that will be interesting to see what he decides to do. But I do think overall Roma do have a very, very, very good chance, because Milan, they also have to play Fiorentina away. That's always difficult. They still have Spal away. We've seen how good they've been at home.
Yeah.
So I think as far as calendar goes, Roma do have a bit of the edge in that regard.
Yeah, you know, I try not to be a prisoner of the moment, but Milan really looks in rough shape to me. To me, it's going to come down to Roma and Atalanta. And as you said, I certainly wouldn't have said that a while ago. So let me ask you about Ranieri, who has been a great story both on and off the pitch at Roma. I think, you know, the word that really comes to mind for me of everything on his go-around at Roma now is being selfless, and it's really paid off. So let me ask you, as someone who covers the team so closely, what has impressed you the most about him?
I think what he's been able to do this side defensively is nothing short of a miracle. Fazio was you could have made the case that he was one of the worst players in all of Serie A this season compared to how he's performed in previous years. I mean, you could have made the case a year or two ago that he was the best defender in Serie A, and then you compare those performances to how he was performing this year under Di Francesco. It looked like a completely different player. It's difficult for me to even fathom how this is the same guy who in these past few weeks has certainly outperformed Kostas Manolas. He's scoring goals. It's just astonishing to me that Ranieri took this team that was a nightmare defensively, and that would be putting it kindly, an absolute nightmare, and he's turned them into a side that is actually formidable defensively. I mean, they've had more clean sheets in the last few weeks with Ranieri than they did in like the first 6 months under Di Francesco. So it's really a testament to the work that he's done at the back, because that is where the problems were. This team has not had problems scoring at all. That, you know, the problems in attack have been non-existent, but at the back, I mean, they leak goals every which way. And Ranieri is really, I mean, if you just listen or read what he says week after week, he always says the word compact, 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 compact. We have to stay compact. And that is nothing that they were under Di Francesco. So I think the most impressive thing is what he's done defensively with essentially the same group of players. I mean, they didn't bring anybody in the winter, despite Monchi saying that they would bring somebody in. Nobody arrived. They stuck with the exact same team. And Ranieri has just turned them into a formidable defensive side. And I think out of all of this, I mean, the biggest regret, the biggest highlight for me is, my God, I mean, if they would have done this back in December or November when it was blatantly evident that something had to be done, as opposed to waiting until March, I don't even think we're having a discussion for the fourth place. I think Roma would have it wrapped up. But here we are. They waited longer than they should have. They paid the price. But again, they're still in this race. So, yeah, I think what Ranieri has done defensively has been, again, nothing short of a miracle.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, I think in one of his first press conferences, he really praised Fazio, called him un pezzo 90 or something like that. And of course, he got mocked viciously on Twitter, yes. But he definitely got the last laugh there. So you mentioned Monchi. So his position as sporting director is at the moment vacant. There's been a lot of rumors. You've covered this extensively. It looks like his right-hand man, Frederick Masada, is going to have some sort of role at Roma, but maybe not the top job as sporting director. So as someone who's been covering this closely, and again, we're recording this on Tuesday, what's the latest on that? How do you see it shaking out?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it has changed within these last 7 to 10 days, and I think a lot of it is directly correlated to the problems that Petrachi has been having at Torino with Cairo, the president. The relationship really has seemed to deteriorate within this last week. And I think we're at the point now where, from what I've been told by people pretty close to the club, that Petrachi will be the next sporting director. I'm pretty confident in saying that. But unfortunately, I think at this point, with Petrachi, I think that means that Masada is going to leave the club because Petrachi is going to be bringing in a lot of his own people. And I do think that we will see Masada join back up with Sabatini, who I think he'll end up at Bologna, but that remains to be seen. But I do think it's going to be Petrachi, because Luis Campos of Lille pulled himself out of the running about a week and a half ago. He was the one that Roma really wanted. He wanted, Roma president James Palotta really wanted him. His right-hand man, the former Spurs sporting director, Franco Baldini, who is the one Palotta trusts the most. He wanted Luis Campos, with Masada sort of being his right-hand man. But that sort of deteriorated over the last week and a half. And I think we are pretty close to hearing something on Petrachi. I wouldn't be surprised if we heard something within the next week or two. And I think that would be a great hire. I think what he's done at Torino, particularly this season, is fantastic. I don't think anybody could argue with his body of work. I mean, he brought this team up from Serie B. He built them out of nothing. His ability to find bargain buys. I mean, if you look at their defense this season, extremely formidable, one of the strongest in all of Serie A. And you look at what he paid for them. I mean, he's just incredible, absolutely incredible. So I think he would be a fantastic addition for Roma. And I know you were a big critic of Monchi, as I was, David. And I think this is the right thing to do because I don't think Roma were in the position to make another risk, to take another risk. I think they needed somebody who understands the landscape of Serie A, who understands the league, is very plugged in. And I think that's what Petrachi represents. And I think he would be the perfect hire. So, for Roma supporters, I think they should be happy about this because I don't know who else realistically could have come. But if I had a wish list, Petrachi certainly would have been at the top of it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the idea of going Campos, anyone from outside of Serie A, would have been an absolute disaster after Monchi. And I'm a huge fan of Petrachi. I think, too, one thing that stands out to me is he builds the teams kind of in the image of his coaches, really plays up to their strengths. I mean, you couldn't have a team that's more like Mazzarri than this current Torino. I think it's a great hire. I completely agree with you. Now, let's get to the question that everyone wants to know more about. There's been quite a bit of buzz recently on Conte and Roma. Again, we're recording this on Tuesday, releasing this on Thursday. Interestingly, John, we had on Monday's show the journalist that used to cover Juve when Conte was there from Gazzetta, and he's the journalist that told him the famous quote on the 10-euro bill at the 100-euro restaurant. You
I wasn't going to bring that up.
The 10-euro bill that got a lot of people excited. You're really plugged in on Roma, so tell us what's going on with Conte and the Giallorossi.
Yeah, so I think all of these rumors with Conte, I think a lot of it is pure perfect timing for Roma. Because if you look at the landscape of all the teams that Conte has been linked to, I mean, it's been PSG, it's been Manchester United, it's been Juve. But all these teams, they have a manager at the moment. Roma are the only ones with a vacancy. So I think a lot of this is timing being extremely in Roma's favor. I feel like they have this very small window, 2-3 weeks before the end of the season, where I think they really, really have to make the most of it, because who knows what's going to happen with these other clubs. Their managers, they could sign renewals, but we all know in the world of football, a renewal doesn't really mean much. You can leave at the drop of a hat. So I really feel like they have this very window of opportunity for them to actually make this happen. This is another thing that if you would have asked me a month ago if Antonio Conte was even a semi-realistic option for Roma, I would have called you crazy. But again, I think this is timing. There are no other realistic vacancies at this moment for him. So if Roma can somehow, I don't know how this is going to happen, because one of the reasons they even appointed Eusebio Di Francesco were his wages were 1.5 million euros. Yep. I mean, if you compare that to Ancelotti, you compare that to Allegri, that's 5-6 times less. It's not even close. But part of me thinks maybe Palotta, and I hope this is the case, maybe Palotta has realized and he's learning and he's growing as a president that you can only, quote-unquote, cheap out so much on a manager. Maybe, in my mind, I'm hoping he sees what Napoli did with Ancelotti and realizes what the value of a top-tier manager can do. I mean, there's only so much they can do in the transfer market year after year after year after year. And since he's been in charge, I think we're coming on almost 8-9 years now. I mean, he has not paid top money for a top manager. I mean, we've had Zeman, we've had Luis Enrique, who was not the same Luis Enrique who won the Champions League with Barcelona. I mean, this was when he was an unknown quantity coming from Barcelona's B-side. We've had Rudy Garcia, who obviously came with a little bit of pedigree. He won the league with Lille. but I don't think anybody would put him in the same ballpark as Antonio Conte. So I think it's time that Palotta finally, you know, raises his hand and say, you know what, I think it's time to actually pay top money for a top manager, because I think he's starting to realize what a top manager can bring and what the difference a top manager brings to his team. And again, he hasn't paid top or big money since he's been at the club. And I'm hoping that since how he's seen this past season go with Di Francesco, I would hope that he's learning that, you know, I have to do this. Because if you have the opportunity to bring Antonio Conte, I just think that's an opportunity you can't pass up. And I do think it's feasible. I honestly do, because we've seen the wages that he's rumored to be asking for, 8, 9, 10 million euros. If he can make just a minor concession, 7 million euros, I think that's where Roma really could make a splash with him and make it happen. And a lot of people are, I feel like this is the biggest part of it, but he and Petrachi are very, very good friends, both from yep. Lecce, went to the same high school, very, very, very close. And I feel like with Roma appointing Petrachi, which I do expect, I feel like that's almost like an ace up Palotta's sleeve that he can really, really play to. So do I think it's possible? Yes. Do I think it will happen? I'm extremely even at this point, because I still find it astonishing that we're even discussing this. I still think it's a long shot. But again, Roma do have this very small window because, again, they're the only one with a vacancy at the moment. I think they need to make the most of it. So we'll see what happens. I'm hoping we hear something within the next week or two. But I think if this is something that's even a remote opportunity, Roma have to do it. And if that means bringing in one less player in the window, if that means spending, you know, X amount of euros in the summer market, then so be it. Because I do think that if Roma do qualify for the Champions League, I don't expect them to have a big overhaul in the summer. Whereas if they don't qualify, I would expect much more turnover. But my gosh, if you can bring Conte to the team, you absolutely have to find a way, because Roma cannot keep doing this with managers. They have to start acting like a big club. This is not, and with all due respect to them, this is not Sassuolo. This is not a smaller side who is not qualifying for Europe. I mean, for the last 5, 6, 7 seasons, they have been in the Champions League. They are playing at a top level. They have to bring in a manager that reflects that top level, and that's just something they haven't had. So, if there's ever been a time for Palotta to come forward and finally open up the checkbook a little bit for a manager, it has to be now. It absolutely has to be now.
Yeah, that would be quite the statement. I mean, maybe Capello is the last manager that Roma
absolutely.
Got. That is, right? That's such a huge splash. I'm with you. That would be really unbelievable statement. So let's close on this. We have to pay tribute to Monchi. One more disaster is the performance of two of his most expensive acquisitions, although over the weekend they showed a pulse. So I have to ask you, between Nzonzi and Pastore, do you see any of them having a role at Roma next season? And if you had to guess which one of the two has a better chance, who would it be?
Oh, well, if it's the Nzonzi that we've seen under Claudio Ranieri, I would absolutely keep him. I think there's no question about his ability, but when he was brought here for the first 6, 7 months under Eusebio Di Francesco, he's playing as a regista, he's playing as a mezzala, just two roles that do not fit him whatsoever. And that reflected in his performances. He was not good at all, but lo and behold, funny how it works when you have a manager who puts you in the correct role. He plays to your strengths, which is what Ranieri has done. Anybody who watches Nzonzi these past 2 weeks, you'll notice just how different Ranieri uses him. He doesn't go past the halfway line. He's sitting right in front of the defense. He's winning aerial duels. He's recovering the ball. He's getting it out to the wide men, and that's it. And he's fantastic at it. He's world-class at it. And that was not something he was given the responsibilities for earlier in the year. I mean, Eusebio Di Francesco was asking him to build up from the back to it was just a disaster with him as a regista. So I would love to see him continue as long as it's in the right role. I do think he would have a good market, though. Whereas Javier Pastore, I don't know how you would find anybody throughout football who would be willing to come anywhere near what Roma paid for him, which was right around 25 million euros. He's earning, including bonuses, right of around 4 million euros net. So I don't know anybody who would be willing to come up with that sort of cash just because he's been injured all year. Nobody is doubting Pastore's ability. I mean, when he's on the pitch, I mean, he's been fantastic for Roma. But, I mean, he made his first start this past weekend since September, which just says everything about his season. It's been a nightmare for him. I believe he's had four different injuries. It's just gone about as poorly as you could imagine for him. So if I had a guess, I would say Pastore would be the one who would be here next season simply because nobody would take him. Whereas in Zonzi, I could see a big French-English side paying big money for him. And frankly, I don't think he would be opposed to going just because he's had a pretty difficult time in the Rome. He's taken quite a bit of abuse. If you just go on YouTube, you can find a number of videos of people saying things to him as he's leaving Trigoria in his car. So I don't think both of them will be here next year. I would expect Nzonzi to leave in the summer. And again, I would just say that for Pastore, if he could be healthy, I do think he's a huge asset. I mean, we saw what he did against Cagliari at the weekend. He was the most dynamic, flashy players on the entire pitch. But the best ability in football is availability, and he's never available. Again, you can't go 7 months in between starts and expect to be a protagonist for your club. So I do expect Pastore to stay. I wouldn't be shocked if Nzonzi left. My guess would be Pastore would be the one who is still here.
Okay, well, my guess is John's going to continue to be a regular on our podcast as long as he wants to. As usual, really appreciate the insight that you offer to us, John. Everyone check out the fantastic S Roma Press. It's both a website. The podcast is outstanding. If you enjoy John's analysis, you can hear everything on Roma there. Then you have the Stadio Serie A show. So, John, always a pleasure to chat with you. Thanks so much for hopping on today.
Absolutely. Looking forward to doing it again, David. Thanks.
All right. Tremendous. Always good to hear from John. Really is like a friend of the family, isn't he, David? So, also, excuse the corny segue, folks, but friends of the family are certainly the people who send in the wonderful Twitter questions that we get every episode. So let's get right to them. David, who is more likely to join Napoli between Irving Chucky Lozano, Ciro Immobile, and Belotti?
Good question. Says our friend Art Morelli, usually sends us music questions. He's a big Napoli fan. So we were talking on Monday about Insigne potentially leaving. Today they tweeted a picture. We're recording this on Wednesday. A picture of Insigne with Mino Raiola. I was joking around with my Di Marzio crew. I was like, I think anytime a player tweets a picture with Raiola is like essentially demanding either a trade or a raise. But it sounds like Insigne wants to stay at Napoli. There was a meeting on Wednesday when we're recording between him, Ancelotti, Giuntoli, De Laurentiis, and it seems he'll stay. So to me, although they don't play on the same side of the pitch, I think Insigne and Lozano, to me, it's like Napoli could really only afford Lozano if they sell someone like Insigne. I guess if Allan were to go, they could afford him. Like when I always think of Napoli, it's kind of Fabian Ruiz. They spent a lot on him, but it was because they sold Jorginho. So we'll see. I think Lozano, while Napoli has been interested in him for quite some time, there's a lot of competition for him, a really intriguing player. So I'm not so sure how realistic. Now, both Immobile and Belotti, to me, it really comes down to how much you believe in Milik and how much you believe that Napoli believes in Milik. Now, I'm a big fan of his. I know he's been inconsistent. Between the two, I would say, I know Immobile is from Napoli. He said he would like to play for the club. Hasn't had a particularly great season for Lazio. Maybe they could do it. Belotti, I've been really impressed with him in 2019. I have to say, I think he's been absolutely outstanding, even when he doesn't score. He does a lot. I could see Ancelotti being very attracted to him as a player. So I'm going to say between these three, I'm going to go with Belotti, although there's the Immobile tie to Napoli. But realistically, I just don't know if any of these three are coming. When I look at Napoli's squad, I think there's other areas they need to improve, assuming Insigne stays on the squad.
All right, David, next Twitter question. Interesting one here. Does Atalanta and Torino's success say more about them, or does it say more about Milan, Inter, and Roma's struggling?
So, I mean, it would be a cop-out to say a little bit of both. So I'm going to go another route. I'm going to say Torino, as much as I like them, I think they are in this part of the standing, still with an outside chance at Champions League because of Milan, Inter, and Roma not being that consistent, Milan really completely falling apart. So as much as I like Torino, I'm saying for them, they are helped by the struggles of these teams. Atalanta, when I look at how well they've done against the top teams and the way they play, I think they are more about what they've done. I think they really are. No team in Serie A runs as much as them, presses their opponents. So I'm going to go Atalanta is on them. Torino is more because of the help of those around them. But Torino still deserves a lot of credit when you look at their payroll, where they are. They still have overachieved and they deserve credit, but they are helped more by the struggles of the other teams.
All right, David, how about this? On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate Ausilio's work at Inter?
So I had to look it up. So Ausilio became the sporting director at Inter shortly after they had signed Icardi. So even though there's been a lot of drama, getting a player like Icardi who scored for Inter, I think over close to 100 goals for Inter for under 15 million. I mean, that's an absolute coup, but we can't give him a win there. But let's look at the rest. So we have a Skriniar we brought in for, it cost $30 million, but his value is like almost tripled. So really good move there. Signed Brozovic, who I think has been a really good player for them. On Bosman signings, he got De Vrij, really, really good player in my opinion. Asamoah, pretty good player, an upgrade over what they had. And Godin is going to be the next one coming in. So really great work on the Bosman signings. The Nainggolan deal, obviously that's a problem losing Zaniolo. Now, I think Ausilio overall has done a good job selling young players to make the plusvalenza needed to get out of FFP jail. So I think he's done really good work there, took advantage of Inter's strong youth system, so he was able to balance the books without having to sell some of his best players. Obviously, the Zaniolo one hurts. Nainggolan's been a bust, but maybe we can blame a little bit Spalletti for really wanting Nainggolan and Ausilio giving his coach the player that he wanted. So the other thing I would say, wing backs are still a problem at Inter. He's tried many different options at right back. I think Asamoah is an adequate left back. I think he's had a pretty good season for them, but issues there. But I'd say other than Brozovic, the midfield is, I think Gagliardini is an okay player, but not starter. So all things considered, I still think Inter does have a good squad. I think going into this season, you and I had them potentially finishing second. I don't know how much we can blame Spalletti for that. So out of 10, I'm going to give him a 7. And I think that's pretty fair, all things considered. Definitely the Nainggolan Zaniolo one is bad. But aside from that, I think overall he's done pretty good work.
Okay, fair enough. David, could Koulibaly still join Manchester United if they only qualify for the Europa League?
So I just don't know how much, you know, I think a club like Manchester United, they've proven it doesn't matter so much if they're in the Champions League or not. They are a huge brand. They can obviously pay them a lot more than Napoli. I'm just not sure how much that is a factor, although, you know, being in the Champions League with Napoli helps. But, you know, realistically, it's not like Napoli are a contender for the Champions League. So I don't think really that matters that much. To me, ultimately, it really matters if Koulibaly wants to leave Napoli. I think that's really what matters. at this time, it really doesn't seem that that's the case. I don't usually put too much stock in what they say publicly, Instagram posts, but everything about Koulibaly, I mean, he's really embraced that city. I actually think all the issues with the racist chants, like, that's actually the way the city has embraced and defended him. It kind of, in a crazy way, makes him more likely to stay than go. So I just don't think Manchester United being in the Champions League or not is a factor at all. I think it really comes down to, does Koulibaly want to make more money, leave Napoli, be at a bigger club that's more prestigious? I think that matters more than being in Champions League versus Europa League.
Okay, David. Which race for the Champions League is more exciting between Serie A and the Premier League?
So I don't, you know, I'm not as familiar with the Premier League one, so I'm going to in a second throw it back to you on this one. I will say that it seems to me that in both leagues, it's almost like a race of who, you know, it's like it seems nobody wants that last spot. Like everyone's sputtering towards it. So to me, they seem pretty comparable. I'd say in Serie A, you know, it's pretty exciting because of the clubs that are involved. You really have a hodgepodge of styles, size of clubs, and personalities. So it's pretty close. I'm not as familiar with the one in the Premier League. So I'll ask you, you know, give us some insight a little bit about, I know you have a horse in the race here, so maybe it's more exciting for you because it's your team's in it, but try maybe to remove that and look at that more objectively. How do you see this one?
Serie A by default. Serie A by default, just because, sure, it is neck and neck in the Premier League, and it probably will come down to the very final day where all of them play at the same time. However, it's just been embarrassing. It's been a race for the Europa League, not a race for the Champions League. It's like nobody wants the Champions League spots at all. I know we've been saying that a little bit about Serie A, but still, I mean, David, Arsenal, in their last 9 possible points, have collected 0. Manchester United, in their last possible 9 points, have collected 1. Chelsea, in their last possible 9 points, have collected 2. And Spurs, in their last possible 9 points, have collected 3. I mean, get me a puke bucket. That is ridiculous. So exciting is not the word. It is certainly not exciting. So I'm saying Serie A wins that by default. By default. So next one, David. What is your strategy for sifting through what's true with all the transfer rumors out there?
Great question. So this is something that I do with my columns on ESPN where, you know, I have to write about the likelihood of transfer rumors in a lot of different leagues. And obviously with the ones in Serie A, I have a lot of insight. With other leagues, you know, I have to sift through a little bit more. Shout out to my friend Gabriele Romano who helps me with all that. So I'll tell you, there's a couple of things that are pretty obvious that you can start off. I mean, there really is a lot of junk transfer rumors. I try not to really pass judgment on the work of others, but there's some that really don't pass the sniff test at all. Like I'll give you examples in Serie A, and I would imagine in other leagues too, you know, there's a certain amount of non-EU players a team can have on their squad. So when a team has filled all their slots and they're linked to another non-EU player, I know right away that's bullshit. So I can take those off the table right away. The other ones that I can usually sift through, I think if you know a thing or two about amortized values, I know this is something we talk a lot on the podcast. You know, there's some that just don't make much sense. You know, like a player whose amortized value is really, really high. And they say, oh, you know, if they sell this player, they're going to finance the purchase of the other player. Then I just look at the amortized value and I'm like, well, that doesn't really make that much sense. I'll give you an example. I think on Juve, and I've said it many times, there are 3 players who this summer could bring a big return. And that's Dybala, Alexandro, and Pjanic because of what's left of their amortized value compared to the market value. There are others that don't fall in that category. So those are some things that I can do. Now, beyond that, I think, you know, what's really important, if you're a fan of a team, the biggest mistake you can make is just look at the transfer rumor from the perspective of your favorite club and saying, do we need this player? Do we have a need, a fit to have him on the squad? Yeah, that's a factor, but there's 3 sides to every transfer rumor, the two clubs involved and the player involved. So if you see a transfer rumor and a player being linked to your favorite team, try to kind of think outside the box and look, does it make sense for the other team to sell him? Does it make sense for them to sell him to us? And does it make sense for the player to want to come to us? So that's usually what I do when I sift through maybe transfer rumors that I don't have firsthand knowledge on.
Fair enough. Very good tips there. All right, David, kind of a funny question here. How does one go about joining an ultra group?
Well, I don't want to make it sound that's like exactly like joining like a gang, like the Bloods and the Chris and or the Mafia or whatnot, but it's really not that much different. I mean, and look, you know, ultra is a very broad definition. Like I have friends that, you know, they go in the curva and they're part of like groups. Like I have in Padova, there's a big Milan club and they organize, you know, trips to San Siro on the bus and they have a section in the curva and they're a club. Now, are those ultras? Probably not. That's just like, you know, local fan club that's in the curva. There are other groups that are really like the Irriducibili that we saw with Lazio or the Drughi for Juve or some of the others for Milan and Inter. Fossa dei Leoni for Milan. I mean, those are really more kind of like, I mean, I'm not going to call them criminals, but they really are more like kind of like gangs like that. So I would think it's not that much different than that. There's really such a hierarchy in all the curvas, who sits where, who stands where. So it's really goes well beyond, you know, like a fan club from like a city going to watch a game. So I would say it's closer to what you would see with maybe a gang than it is, you know, a local group of supporters from a city going together.
All right, David, what is your opinion on the Libertines?
Okay, so this question we got a while back, so I didn't respond soon. So actually, really good question. This is actually one of my favorite bands, and I'm old, so when I think of the Libertines as a recent band, it's kind of funny because they were founded 20 years ago, and in my mind, this is more of a more recent band that I really like. They're not in existence right now. I think they did a reunion a few years ago, and I really, really like them. Their self-titled album, The Libertines, I really love that record. It's Gun to the Head. That might be my favorite record of the 2000, the millennium that's not from Radiohead. I really, really dig it. I know a lot of people like their first album more, but I absolutely adore that self-titled album. Was the soundtrack to really one of the last crazy period of my life before you know, I got married, before I started focusing on my career. So every time I hear a song off that album, it brings me right back to that time. So I really enjoy it. You know, they were one of the last bands that was like a true rock band, dangerous. You didn't know if they were going to show up for a gig or not. I think Pete Doherty, their main songwriter and singer, is an absolute genius. He's a troubled genius, but he really is. There's a lot of great songs. I love the vocal harmonies he had with Carl Barat, the other member, main member of the group. So, yeah, I'm a huge fan. I actually really, really like them. They just really, you just don't see rock bands like that anymore. Now they're like really so safe. So Image and whatnot, and the Libertines were kind of like a train wreck, and I really enjoyed being along for the ride for it. So today is a treat for me. You guys know I'm very excited when we have our next guest, Andrew Barker, back on the podcast, because not only do we talk about Inter, who is a fascinating team for Calcio, but we're going to chat a little bit about movies, and today we're going to focus on documentaries because there's a lot going on with that. So Andrew, as always, for those of you not familiar with him, he's a senior features writer at Variety, one of the most important publications on pop culture, movies especially, and a connoisseur of Serie A and a big Inter fan. So Andrew, always a pleasure to chat with you. Welcome back to Calcio Land.
Thanks for having me, David.
All right. So, Andrew, I've been, you know, now that we're going really into the final stretch of the season, I've been asking our returning guests to kind of give me an assessment of the teams they follow. So usually I ask for a letter grade, but since you are a great movie reviewer, I'm going to ask you to kind of tell me how you would describe this interseason if you were writing a movie review about what you've been watching.
Right. I would say, I guess the gist of my review would be that if you're just looking for like an entertaining, eventful couple hours at the cinema, then, you know, Inter 2019 is worth $12 for sure. But it's definitely not going to win any awards. You know, it had major pacing problems. The director was always kind of losing control of the film. The actors were totally inconsistent from one scene to the next. There were way too many subplots and side plots, and it was hard to keep track of the main story. I think if it had a better director in charge, maybe it could have been really something special. And, you know, it wasn't a disaster. It was a solid, you know, B kind of film, but just never lived up to all the, like, marketing and the pre-release hype, I guess.
Well said. Yeah, I think it's perfect because actually I think, look, as it stands now, they'd be back in the Champions League, which really was the only objective this season. Right. So I agree with you. Right. And how they got there was certainly with a lot of side turns and whatnot. So speaking of that, last time I had you on was right after Icardi had lost the captain's armband. So I want to ask you, how do you feel about him in these days right now that he's been back for a little while? And in general, how has your perception of him changed since the event that we found out he lost the captain's armband to Handanovic?
You know, it's funny because, like last time we talked, it really felt like a kind of a cataclysmic event in just the relationship between Icardi and the club. And, you know, now with a little bit of distance from it's almost like it's kind of a reminder that he really is kind of the same guy he's always been, you know, which is almost like a really charming but unreliable boyfriend, you know, where he'll like do all these great things for you for a while and he'll kind of earn your devotion and make you a big fan, and then suddenly he'll do something awful that just makes you go like, all right, that's it, like, done, we're through, I'm never speaking to him again, and then he'll start to like win you back again little by little, and somehow it works. I guess the thing is, I mean, with him being made captain and everything, maybe I thought that he had matured a little more than that and kind of moved past that phase of his life, but I guess not. You know, I guess he's just the same guy. It's interesting because I remember when we talked, like, I legitimately thought at the time that Icardi was just gone, that there was no chance he had any future at the club. And you were kind of like, you know, I think he stays. And I don't know. I wonder, you know, I kind of leaning more toward your opinion there. I think the impression I get is that Icardi and Spalletti's futures are kind of intertwined in a way. Like, yep. I mean, because that's the relationship that seems beyond repair there. So I almost wonder if it's a case of if Spalletti stays, Icardi goes, and if Spalletti goes, then Icardi probably stays. Because, I mean, him staying makes sense because just, you know, the whole thing was just bad for everyone. Like, you know, Icardi's stock is now at a low ebb. And Inter probably missed out on a lot of points they might have had if they had him fully fit playing the whole time. So it almost seems like it's in everyone's interest if he stays on a bit. But I just don't know if Spalletti stays, which Morata seemed to be implying that he would. I mean, those two just don't seem like they're even speaking hardly. So I don't know. I still can't figure out what I think is happening there. I'm curious what your take on it is now.
Yeah, I mean, I really haven't changed my mind too much. I mean, I always felt, especially Wanda really pushed her luck, was trying to get another extension, doing the usual tricks, which, you know, are normal for an agent. But I think Inter called their bluff. I never felt for one second her or Icardi wanted to leave. And I'm with you on the Spalletti thing. I don't see both returning. So if I had to put a percentage, I'm still putting 60%. That Icardi is staying. That would be my guess. I mean, I asked someone who knows recently, they told me there's just really no market for him right now. So we'll see. But I think it might be a blessing in disguise. I think long term, as you said, nobody gained by what happened, and maybe the status quo isn't such a bad thing. So let me ask you about another bad boy on Inter. This is Nainggolan, and I loved your tweet from a few days ago, where you said there's very few professional athletes that genuinely hate their team's rivals, like Raja hates Juve. So he had that great goal. So I want to ask you, When you look at that goal, do you see that as what's going to be remembered as his best moment at the club? Or do you think this can be the starting point of him bouncing back and being, you know, a fairly important piece for Inter moving forward?
You know, the thing about that goal is I always remember back in the darker days, Inter signed Ezequiel Schelotto.
Yeah.
Who was really one of the worst players Inter signed in the modern era. I mean, for sure. But he scored one totally pivotal goal in the derby against Milan. And because of that, I mean, you know, even an Inter fan who will agree that he was a terrible, terrible purchase is like, well, he had that one goal. So I think this definitely gives him, you know, a kind of a prime position in the hearts of the fans, for sure. Some brownie points. But I don't know. I think thinking about whether he can bounce back next season, like, I give him an outside chance of doing that. And I think mostly just for the reason that, you know, whatever you think about the decision to make that transfer, you're looking at him and he's a high wage player who's in his 30s. And he has a very particular personality and lifestyle. So the likelihood that we sell him seems small to me. And on his side, I mean, he's almost become kind of halfway a joke since he came to Inter. So he has a lot to prove to avoid ending his career kind of ignominiously, right? So
yeah.
I see him staying because that's the easiest thing probably for both sides. And I think the real problem with Nainggolan is that he was brought in to be like a real protagonist in the starting 11 this season and to kind of be the spine of that of the midfield and the attack, which is obviously a mistake. So I think if he comes back next season, sort of humbled, sort of knowing that he has to fight for a starting place in the lineup, I do think he could maybe surprise some people. You know, he could almost be kind of like that Charlie Sheen in Major League kind of, you know, wild card, you know, that you bring in. I think that'd be a much better role for him at this point in his career rather than what Spalletti was obviously kind of imagining him being, the kind of linchpin he was for Roma, which I don't think he has in him anymore. But I still think there's a possibility that the transfer in the long run pays dividends. Outside chance.
Okay. So now let's talk about Spalletti. So I know, I mean, we're both in agreement that it's very next impossible to see him and Icardi back together, but let's try to take him a little bit more in a vacuum aside from that. So give me your take on him. It sounds by your movie review of Inter season, maybe the director was a little bit lacking. So let me ask you if A, you would take him back next season. As I always like to say, it's easy to sack the manager, much harder to find someone better. Who would have to be a name that comes in that you're like, okay, this is an upgrade?
Yeah, I mean, that's the crux of it right there, you know? I mean, you know, the thing is, I look at, you know, Spalletti in these last several matches, and he just doesn't have the bearing of a man who is, like, really fighting to keep his job so much as someone who's like fighting for the bonus he's going to get if he makes the Champions League, you know, like that's what I see for him, you know, like I think he's done a lot for this club. But I see him really kind of visibly butting up against the limits of what he can accomplish here. And you just, you see his comments, you see his demeanor, and there's just nothing that suggests he's enjoying himself here.
Yeah.
You know, like I look at the last two matches with Roma and Juve, and in both cases, you had a situation where the score was level going into the last 15 minutes and Inter was arguably playing better and looking more likely to score. And, you know, a coach who really believes in the project, you know, who has like ambition to kind of really keep improving would have gone for the win, I would think. And in both cases, you saw Spalletti pull attacking players, kind of go more conservative to preserve the draw. And I don't think that was necessarily a bad strategy. I wouldn't fault that, you know, because drawing with Juve was respectable. And drawing with Roma means, you know, that we got a point and we have a head-to-head advantage with Roma. So there's a lot of sense that makes, but it just doesn't like scream confidence, you know?
Yeah,
it's sort of, he's trying to check off the box he needs to check. But as you said, you know, firing him is easy, replacing him is hard. And I would hate to see us, you know, roll the dice on someone untested, you know, like we did with De Boer or Stramaccioni. And then you look at the fact that obviously Roma needs a new manager. Milan probably needs a new manager. And I guess Juve, you know, winning 8 Scudetti in a row means nothing to the most spoiled fans in the country. So they could be getting new ones too. And I don't see who the manager would be who isn't going to go to one of those. I mean, I look at Antonio Conte, and he's obviously the most promising candidate, even though I've never been a big fan of his personally. And he would definitely, I mean, he would work with Maratha, you know, being part of this restoring discipline and the kind of militaristic professionalism to the club. Conte would definitely follow through on that. But I don't know who else that would be that would replace Spalletti, who wouldn't risk having Inter just have another disaster and waste the season. I mean, I think he's gotten us as far as he can get us, but yeah, without a really sure thing. I mean, I don't think Pochettino's around. I don't know who else we'd go after. So I don't know, man. I'm really kind of in the dark, but I would prefer an upgrade. I would prefer Conte or someone like that. Because I think he would just, you know, unquestionably do better with the players that we yeah. have than Spalletti does. But I don't see it in the cards. I mean, I think Maratha might have been being completely honest when he said that the coach next year is Spalletti.
Yeah, I mean, he's got that long-term, really long-term contract, which really helps him. But I'm with you. I think if it's not Conte, I could see Spalletti's thing. So let me ask you another question that I've been asking a lot of our guests that focus on teams specifically. So we have four games to go. Inter's better than last season, I would say. But let me ask you, of the current players that are on the team now, who do you think are good enough to be starters next year if the goal is to bridge the gap with Juve even further?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. And I'm going to tackle that literally, you know, which might seem overly generous, but I don't want to go all like Fantacalcio and talk about, you know, whether a player is the best person we could have in that position, but just like could a decent coach theoretically win a Scudetto with his player as a starter. So honestly, I think starting goalkeeper, starting defenders, yes to everyone. I think, you know, within the next year or two, Skriniar and De Vrij will be arguably the best center back pairing in the league. And then there's Diego Godin incoming, you know, should theoretically we have a coach who likes to play three at the back. So I think all of them could win the Scudetto. I think Asamoah could. Even Danilo D'Ambrosio, who may be one of the least sexy members of the squad, I actually think he's perfectly adequate, and he works hard, and he really doesn't actually make that many mistakes, honestly. Now, to be clear, are there better right backs in the world? Yes, many. And would I prefer a better right back there? Of course. But could we win the Scudetto with him there? I think so. You know, I think plenty of teams have won Scudetti with worse players than him in the lineup. Like, I think Conte's first couple Juve sides had worse players than Brozovic yeah. in the starting 11. You know, Padoin or Mauricio Isla or someone. So I say yes to the defense. And obviously the attack is a bit of a question mark because Icardi is an open question. And I do suspect Perisic is probably leaving. But our forwards as they currently exist, you know, Icardi / Lautaro, Politano, Perisic, I think that's good enough. So yes to all of them. But as for the midfield, I think the only midfielder we have currently who would be starting for a Scudetto challenging team is Marcelo Brozovic.
Yeah.
So I think that's the problem, you know, which is not to say the other midfielders are like useless, you know, like Gallardini is a good squad player. We talked about Nainggolan. But as starters, I just don't think so. I mean, Vecino, no. Joao Mario, no. Borja Valero, no. So I think that's where the real transfer work needs to be done, you know, because if you, you know, you put like my man crush Nicolò Barella next to Brozovic, and then you have, say, you know, a Milinkovic-Savic up top, or, you know, you get a Rakitic, a Pjanic, a Vidal yeah. to kind of play in a three-man midfield. Like, that is a team that could genuinely worry Juve or Napoli, even with the defense as it is and the forward line as it is.
Well said.
Am I being crazy? Or
No. I'm completely with you there. It's like I recently did a column where I was looking at the most important players on each team right now, which is kind of where I start to get ready for the summer transfer window. And I put Brozovic as the most important player on Inter because the drop off around them is significant. So, yeah, I'm completely with you there. I think Rakitic on Inter would be absolutely incredible. Let's shift to movies. So I promised you that John Singleton passing away wasn't the reason why I asked you to come on the podcast, which unfortunately, deaths in the world of pop culture have brought you on the podcast. It has nothing to do with this because right. I wanted to talk to you about documentaries. But since we're on the subject, and I passed away yesterday, I know he's a director that you've really liked. We've talked about him, I think, when we were talking about Green Book a while back. So tell our listeners a little bit about John Singleton and what really stands out to you about him as a director.
Yeah, I forgot we talked about him before. So John Singleton was, he's a really interesting director to think about because, I mean, he's someone, you know, whenever you talk about sort of someone's defining achievement, you always say like, oh, this will be the first line in their obituary kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so with John Singleton, I mean, you literally saw the first line in all of his obituaries was Boys in the Hood. And that will always be central to his legacy. And so what's interesting about that is that that was, you know, his first film. And there's always this weird sort of thing that happens when someone makes their biggest cultural statement right out of the gate. You know, like in music, I think about Nas and I think about Oasis, you know, of these artists who
like The Range.
Yeah, right. But I mean, like both, they're both like, well, they're also both around the same time as John Singleton. They're also both artists who had these really long, successful careers, but are forever going to be judged on the first thing they did back in their early 20s. And you can kind of sense that it weighs on them a little bit. And so I think that's similar with Singleton, but it's hard to overstate just how important that movie was. You know, he made it when he was 23, he's fresh out of college. He wrote it, he directed it. It got him two Oscar nominations and he pretty much invented a whole subgenre of film with that movie. You know, after Boys in the Hood, you know, you had Menace to Society, you had Juice, you had Above the Rim. I mean, you even had like the Wayans brothers making a whole parody of a genre that would not have existed without him.
Yeah, I remember
him.
That.
Yeah, yeah. And you look at who he cast in the film. You know, that was Cuba Gooding Jr.'s first movie, and he goes on to win an Oscar. That was Regina King's first movie. She had done some sitcoms and stuff, but then she goes on to win an Oscar. It was Morris Chestnut's first movie. It was Ice Cube's first movie. You know, like, I don't think there's anyone else in Hollywood who would have thought, hey, you know what we should do? We should take the scariest dude from N.W.A., a guy who has literally zero acting experience and cast him in a major dramatic role in this movie, you know? And now of course, you know, Cube has probably made more money as a movie star than he ever made as a rapper. So that's a truly ridiculous number of stars that John Singleton can claim to have discovered with his very first movie. And this is also, you know, I mean, also importantly, this is a time when pretty much the only black men out there directing proper studio films are him and Spike Lee and then basically no one else. So I mean, the importance of that movie is just enormous. But it's not like it's his only good movie. I mean, I love Poetic Justice. I loved Rosewood. I did a movie called Baby Boy, which is super underrated. And he definitely had his time in the wilderness after that, you know, doing some kind of mediocre paycheck projects. But he was starting to do interesting things in TV more recently. Like he did the best episode of that OJ miniseries. He did a 30 for 30 on Marion Jones.
That was great.
Yeah. So it's really sad to see him go at, I think, 51, because he clearly was seemed to be entering a new phase in his career. So it's quite tragic.
Oh, I didn't know that he did an episode of that OJ series. Which one was that? Which episode was that?
It was called The Race Card. So it's
when
they're kind of redecorating his house and everything. So I thought really good work.
That was great. Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Okay, so let me ask you, other than Inter, originally the plan was to have you on to talk about documentaries because I know you recently worked on a big feature for Variety on the 10 documentary filmmakers to watch in 2019, which we'll get to in a second. But let me ask you first, would you say, you know, you're a movie critic, you've been following this for a long time. Would you say that right now this is the golden age of documentaries because of all the platforms, all the avenues to make them?
You know, yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'd say but it definitely feels like something like a golden age for sure. I mean, you know, there's no question that the quality of the documentaries we're getting to see has been extremely high. And, you know, especially in the last year, you know, you saw several documentaries doing extremely well financially. Like I think there were maybe four documentaries that earned like between $10 and $20 million, which is crazy. I mean, you look at previous years and there's just maybe one that breaks into a couple million. So I mean, it's obvious that something is going on. And, you know, I think the fact that we're seeing so many of these great documentaries is two things. It's the first piece is a bit obvious, which is just that you know, technologically, it's now possible for anyone who thinks they have an interesting story to tell to just get an iPhone, get some editing software, make a documentary short all by themselves, use that short to get some funding, to expand it into a feature, get it into a festival, and then they're off, you know. And that's been the case for a while now. But the second part that is vital that you kind of mentioned is you have these streaming platforms and companies, like especially Netflix and Hulu, also HBO and some others, who are really actively going out and buying these tiny documentaries out of festivals and putting them on a platform where they're available to millions of people. And then you see them taking these filmmakers who, like I said, you know, have made a little film in their bedroom somewhere and giving them new films that are commissioned, you know. And that's been huge. I mean, you can compare it, I think, very broadly to what happened with independent film in the 90s a little bit.
Yeah,
because it's not like the 90s was like the birth of indie film or anything, you know, because you'd had, you know, Jim Jarmusch and John Cassavetes and whoever making these independent films all through the 70s and 80s. But they had a limited impact because they were playing in like two or three cities. Then all of a sudden in the 90s, you get Miramax and New Line and the studio indie divisions who are taking these like scrappy little films and putting them in multiplexes in Little Rock and Peoria and whatever. And the whole landscape changes. So I think, you know, ideally we're seeing that effect on a smaller scale because we're talking documentaries, obviously. And I think that's bringing a lot of voices out that wouldn't normally be there, you know? I mean, because you consider like, as I mentioned earlier, like where documentaries were not that long ago in terms of audiences. And then you think about the number of people who are watching like Wild Wild Country or The Inventor or Minding the Gap or Free Solo. And that's an enormous shift. And anytime that you can prove that there's a potential ROI on giving these really young filmmakers a shot and giving them looks and picking up their movies, then that really benefits the whole genre.
Very interesting. So now let's talk about the feature that you worked on. I read it was very interesting. So on Variety, you guys wrote about the 10 documentary filmmakers to watch in 2019. So, you know, anyone that really, a couple that really stand out to you that our audience should really be keeping their eye out for?
Yeah. And first off, really, thanks for giving a shout out to that section. It's probably one of my favorite things I do every year, just getting to find these people and spotlighting them. So I really appreciated the little signal boost you gave. But yeah, so I'll just point out a couple that will be available for people to watch.
Perfect.
Like, so that, yeah, because some of them are kind of up in the air, haven't been picked up yet, or who knows when. But one that people can watch immediately, which does have a sports theme, is this Netflix series called Losers by Mickey Dusage.
Where
every episode is about like a noble failure in sports, which I think is a really fascinating idea. And I like the series a lot. So that one's out now. A couple will be coming out soon. One of which is Knock Down the House by Rachel Lears, which is a documentary where she follows four female congressional candidates for a year or two in advance of the 2018 midterms.
Yeah.
And one of them was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And so she was here following her around like long before most of us have heard of her. So you get to see her like giving speeches to empty rooms and going door to door and then become this national figure, which is really a trip. There's a great movie called Edge of Democracy by Petra Costa, which is about the current political situation in Brazil. And she gets a lot of access to Lula, you know, the former president. And then there's on kind of a very different note, there's a film by Ben Berman, which is called Untitled Amazing Jonathan Documentary. And that's actually the title. And it's one of those films where halfway through you're like asking, like, is this actually a documentary? Like, is he just messing with me? Like, what is this? And it does some really fun stuff. And so that's a really fun one. And all those will be streaming, I think, by the summer.
Yeah, that last one that you mentioned when I read the description, that really, really caught my eye. Okay, so let me ask you this question, because I'm curious to get your take on this. I'm not going to ask you again about Bohemian Rhapsody. We've talked a lot about it. But
we're done.
To me, what's
we're done with that movie.
We're done. But this is what I want to ask you about. So, you know, what's the criteria, in your opinion, where, you know, they should make like a Hollywood movie as opposed to making a documentary, right? I mean, we have the Elton John movies about to come out. he's still alive. I guess you could watch a documentary. I thought the Motley Crue movie on Netflix was better than I thought it was going to be. So I want to ask you, you know, when do you think it's just better to make a Hollywood biopic with actors as opposed to just making a kick-ass documentary on an artist?
You know, I mean, just for me, I mean, obviously the reason you make a full-scale biopic is because you're probably going to make more money with it. But I mean, but just thinking about what I like to see, I mean, I think, how would I put this? I'm a lot more forgiving with, and I give a lot more leeway to documentaries that are sort of straight ahead, you know, that are just cradle to grave life story.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, at least then, you know, you're seeing a firsthand account and footage, you know, as opposed to just some guy cosplaying as a rock star for 2 hours, you know. So I think with a big biopic, what I like to see is someone who has really thought of a specific window to focus on,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's what I like, you know, like maybe it's, you know, the person's, you know, crowning achievement, you know, they're the album that made them a star or whatever. Or maybe it's like a lesser known chapter that just reveals something bigger about them. You know, like, I mean, you know, it's not like a music or documentary, but I think about Spielberg's Lincoln. You know, mm-hmm. like when I heard about that project, I thought the idea of watching like a 4-hour Steven Spielberg movie about the entire life of Abraham Lincoln just sounded like absolute death. You know, I was just dreading it. But by focusing on this one, like really specific period and this like legislative battle in granular detail, it told a really complete and coherent story that revealed a lot about Lincoln without telling us everything about him. Or like, I don't know if you, I'm sure you've seen The Damned United about Brian
yeah.
Clough. Yeah. 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 Like the way that, you know, it's not giving us Brian Clough's career and his life story. It's talking about his biggest failure and what that tells you about him as a person and about the way the rest of his career played out. And so like, that's what I want to see is not, I want to make a movie about Elton John, but I want to make a movie about Elton John recording Goodbye Yellow Brick Road for this reason. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, it makes perfect
yeah.
sense.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's cool.
Broadly. Yeah.
Cool. So let's close on this. So we're going to tie it back to Calcio a little bit. I saw you tweeted about it. I think you're just as excited, maybe more than I am, on the documentary they made on Maradona that's going to be at the Cannes Film Festival. I have to say when I saw the trailer of it, that was more exciting than the new Tarantino flick, the Star Wars movie combined. I was like, this is just so much more exciting. So let me ask you, what can you tell us about this? And then I want to ask you, what about Maradona himself makes him such a great character for a documentary, in your opinion?
Yeah, I'm glad you had the same reaction I did. I feel like we're in a, you know, it's a it's a small group of people who are more excited about a Maradona documentary than Star Wars, but I'm definitely there. So, I mean, yeah. So, you know, as you already mentioned, you know, it's playing at Cannes, and the director is Asif Kapadia, who is just an exceptional filmmaker, one of my favorite documentary filmmakers. This is his third documentary in what he's referred to as a trilogy about troubled child geniuses, was I think what he called it. Mm-hmm. And so the first one was Senna, about the Brazilian Formula One driver.
Which was amazing.
Which was great. And the second was Amy, which is about Amy Winehouse. And I mean, I guess the obvious difference between Maradona and those two is that he didn't die young, although, you know, he probably could have.
yeah.
But you definitely see how he fits in with that theme, you know. And what's great about Kapadia as a director is, I mean, and you know this if you've seen either of those two movies, is he puts his films together entirely through really deep archival footage with off-screen interviews, like voiceovers. So you don't have the whole kind of behind-the-music style talking head thing. You're really immersed in the period itself, and you hear people talking. And so apparently he had access to Maradona's personal video archives, and he just dug up some really deep stuff in here, at least that's what it seems like. And so, I mean, I love Senna, even though there's probably no sport I care less about than race car driving. It was just a great film. And, you know, I liked Amy Winehouse a lot. You know, I saw her live. I thought she was great, but I wasn't like a super fan. But Amy, that documentary, I mean, that was one of my favorite documentaries of the last 10 years. So to have him doing a movie about something I care about as much as Maradona, and specifically his time at Napoli, I mean, that's like fantacalcio filmmaking for me. And as to why Maradona is so exciting as a character in a documentary, I mean, he's got everything, you know, like,
yeah.
I mean, just on the sports side, you've got a once in a lifetime, if not once in several lifetimes player and all the titles and the skill. You got the socio-political dimension of it, you know, and what he meant to Argentina that was coming out of this terrible military dictatorship, and what he meant to Southern Italy, you know, which had really been left out in the cold from all the prosperity and development in the North. And Maradona really gave them a way to just like raise a big middle finger to like Milan and Turin and everything. And then obviously, I mean, just the man himself and his personality, you know, his self-destructive tendencies, his secret love child, the cocaine, the associations with the Camorra, you know, like, I mean, if this isn't the best film ever made, I'm going to be super disappointed. But, you know, it's interesting, you know, because watching that, you know, because as you mentioned, the trailer really shows him going into the San Paolo for the first time.
Yeah.
Crazy trailer. I have a question, since you're like the transfer guru. Like, do you ever think we could see a deal like Maradona going to Napoli at the prime of his career again? Because I think, like, even with like a PSG or a Man City with their new zillionaire owners, you don't see a team just come out of like the absolute hinterlands, sign one player, and then start winning titles like 2 years later. I mean, it would be like if Parma like announced tomorrow that they'd signed Neymar, you know, and thanks to that, like the whole balance of power in the league shifts. Like, is that even possible?
Well, you kind of answer that a little bit with, you know, his connection to the Camorra and all that. I mean, I think you really said it beautifully. Like, there was a lot of pent up anger in Napoli. They were looking to make a splash. Interestingly, Di Marzio's dad, of all people who used to coach Napoli, he's the one that had got to Maradona in the late 70s before he went to Barca and kind of planted the seed on him eventually coming to Napoli. I don't think anything like that, you know, just in the world that we live in today, I just don't know if it's realistic that we'll have anything similar. So you really explained it beautifully. Like, I lived through that. I mean, I was pretty young when it happened, but long and short of it, I just don't think we'll have anything quite like that. Like, as you said, we could have a Man City, a team like that, that like a huge rich owner buys it and they do something like that. But Maradona's personality just fit into the city so perfectly. So you would need a character that fits the situation and the city so perfectly. It's actually really a fascinating story, like everything that happened with him. I mean, I have to tell you, I'm a huge Maradona guy. The first time I met Di Marzio in person, I was much more interested in asking him about his dad and what he knew about Maradona than anything else. When I met Moggi, I didn't care about Del Piero, Ibrahimovic, none of that. I was like, just tell me about Maradona. I just want to know about that stuff. So, yeah, but to answer your question, no, I just don't think there will ever be anyone quite like him or a transfer quite like him. And I think that trailer really kind of gives you a little bit of a hint of why it was truly so special. So yeah, I'm with you. If it's not the greatest movie ever, it's going to be disappointing because they have everything needed to make that happen. So no, Andrew, I can't thank you enough. You know, it's such a treat for me to talk movies and even culture with you. So keep up the great work. You're always welcome here. Thanks for all your insight, everyone. Definitely check out the feature on Variety on the 10 documentaries filmmakers to watch. Check out all of Andrew's work. I devour everything he publishes. And when you do the review, though, of the Maradona documentary, I'm getting a signed copy, right? You told me you would. So
if that happens, for sure. Yeah.
So. All right. Sounds good. All right. Well, thanks so much, buddy. Always such a pleasure to catch up with you.
Thank you, sir.
That's the show for today. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to everyone who sent in a question. As you guys know, we record a lot of these. So if you have another question on Serie A, transfers, TV, music, film, please send it in using the CalcioLand hashtag. And if you enjoyed the show, this is a free show available to all. Please leave us a review on iTunes. It takes 2 seconds to leave us a 5-star rating. If you leave a comment, Alex and I read them all. And these testimonials are great because they are from our listeners. They help us attract a bigger audience. And if you like all the content on the Calcio Land podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon. We have various tiers for you just to listen enhanced version of the podcast. We have a tier where you can read a lot of original blogs from me. We'll have Alex once in a while do a video, and I answer a lot of questions there. I think that'll be a lot of fun year-round, and especially during the transfer window. So thank you very much for the support, and we look forward to chatting with you in the next few days.